There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Bye, bye, baby, bye, baby, I am bye, baby, I am bye, baby, I am bye, baby, I am bye, baby, I am.
Welcome to the Brown Baby Podcast. I am your host, Nikesh Shukla. This is a parenting podcast where my guests and I talk about how to raise kids to be joyful in bleak times when we're so sad and angry about everything. It's an optimistic podcast, I promise you. Each week, I talk to writers, comedians, chefs, musicians, people who are parents in some way or not, and we talk about what it is to raise kids now. It's a podcast inspired by my memoir, Brown Baby, a memoir of race, family and home, a memoir about parenting that asks the question, how do I raise my kid to be joyful in bleak sad times when I'm so sad and angry about everything? Synergy! Haha. Dad jokes in abundance on this Monday morning as I record this intro. The book asks a lot of questions about how to navigate tricky issues like grief, racism, climate collapse, gender, mental health, and it's my attempt to write a hopeful book. As we come to season one of the podcast, I really urge all of you who haven't picked the book up yet to please buy it, especially now that bookshops are open. Yes, I'm recording this on the week of April 12th, where in the UK, bookshops are opening again. And I just want to take a second to shout out my new local independent bookshop, Gloucester Road Books, on Gloucester Road in Bristol, just at the top of Pigsty Hill. Please go there if you are local to Bristol and support. Or if you're in Bristol and not near Gloucester Road, then Storysmith Books is another bookshop I love, and Max Minerva's as well. Basically, there are loads of great bookshops in Bristol. But there are also great bookshops everywhere. Go and buy your books from bookshops. Go and buy some books. Books, books, books. Okay. Enough of that. I'm feeling very silly today. I've not slept very well. I did not sleep very well. God, what a weird loose intro this is. But I'm going to keep it like this, right? Because this is just me and my true self. All right. This week's guest is Mira Jacob. I am so glad to get Mira on the podcast. When I decided I was going to do this, she was the first person I contacted to be on it. She is an author I absolutely adore. Her writing is funny and tender and just close to my heart. When I was writing Brown Baby, I came across her graphic memoir, Good Talk, which is a series of conversations between her and her mixed-race child about racism in Trump's America. She talks about losing her father, trying to make her white in-laws understand what's happening in the country, and her journey to self-acceptance from being a child. It's brilliant. I love it so much. She also wrote the magical novel, The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing. If you haven't checked out her graphic essay about her child's fascination with Michael Jackson, please do. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. I've also linked to her books and to Brown Baby in my bookshop.org affiliate shop. I am an affiliate of bookshop.org, which means that I have my own shop. And half of the sales from that shop go to independent bookshops, and I get a cheeky little commission as well. So please do pick up our books. It's a great way to support a free podcast. All right, I'll be back at the end to say goodbye. I think you've heard enough of this weird intro vibe. But so for now, please enjoy Brown Baby Season 1, Episode 14, Mira Jacob. Just need to run myself through all these steps. And I'm going to, just for safety, and I'm going to record myself on, oh, I am
Internal port audio error. Oh dear. I don't even know what that means.
We have nothing but sympathy from me.
I mean, sure, sure, he said, I can record the podcast myself. Doesn't matter. I can work it out.
It shouldn't be that hard.
Yeah. Okay, so should we just go into it and then I'm not taking up too much of your time?
Yeah, sure. I mean, is it working? Do you need to test it to make sure it's recording or we're fine?
Yeah, no, it is all working. Okay, I have got a Zoom that is recording. You have got a voice memo that is recording. I have got another program that is recording. I can hear my children in another room. I will record an intro where I gush lovingly about you and your work and Good Talk and how it changed my life and all the rest of it. But in the meantime, I am going to say, welcome to the Brown Baby Podcast, Mira Jacob. How are you?
Oh, good. Thank you for having me. How are you?
I am fine. I am fine. I just had to go and pick one child up from school with the other child crying and sniveling the whole way because we had to turn the television off in order for us to go and do this pickup thing. And it reminded me that sometimes using the television as a babysitter has awful consequences.
Yes, totally. Especially right now. I mean, but also, what are you supposed to do right now other than use the television or the computer at certain times? But also, I just feel like it's their reality and then you're taking away their reality. So it's a little bit like, what are you doing to me?
Yeah, exactly. Now, I am really, really excited to talk to you about on this podcast about Good Talk and obviously Brown Baby, because I really feel like my book sort of inadvertently became in conversation with yours. I feel like they're both in dialogue. I read your book mm-hmm. just after I'd kind of begun writing mine, and I felt real kinship with you. And for people who are coming to the podcast who haven't come across Good Talk, do you want to just say in your words a couple of years down the line, having talked about it to death, do you want to just tee up what Good Talk is?
Yeah, sure. So Good Talk is, I think the subtitle is A Memoir in Conversations. And it's a graphic book, and it consists of, I'm sorry, can you hear all of New York in the background just now?
I love it. Okay. It's like paying for a folio track, but
okay, great, free. Great. All right, as long as we're all good with that, we are in New York, and it is going to New York upon us. it's a series of drawn conversations, and basically, it started out with this one conversation with my son, who was sort of figuring out that he was brown at the same time that Black Lives Matter was rising in America and the violence against Black Americans was becoming more widely certainly discussed. And so it starts with that conversation, but then it really goes on to a lot of formative conversations over my life. And the way I drew it is I kind of drew all of us, me, my family, anyone I was having conversations with as paper dolls. And then you kind of, our expressions never really change, but the dialogue changes a lot. Mm. And the things that we say to each other obviously move the narrative forward. So how's that?
Yeah, no, that's perfect. I think, obviously, I'd read your novel, the Sleepwalk. I'm about to butcher the title, but The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dance.
Hey, that was good. The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing. I'm amazed.
I worried that I was going to mash it up with another title by accident. But then was eagerly waiting for another novel from you. And then this essay about your child and his obsession with Michael Jackson and race appeared on the internet, and it blew my mind. And I read it around the time that I was sort of having similar conversations with my daughter about skin color and dolls, and then the book dropped, and what I really loved about it was how honest you were about difficult conversations that you've had, because the book, one of the sort of backdrops of the book is the kind of the run-up to the 2016 election and the aftermath of the 2016 election and the kind of the fallout that happens on at a family level. And I loved how honest you were about how the conversations with your child were sort of impacting and informing the conversations you were having with your wider networks.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's so funny because I think at that stage, you know, he was 6 to 8 in the book. So right before in 2016, he was 8 years old, but 6 years old when the book release starts. And I think one of the things that children will do, as I'm sure you're aware, is they will ask you these questions that you think you know the answers to. You're like, oh yes, I will tell you this thing. And then in the course of answering them, you're like, that is insane. What am I telling you? This is completely wrongheaded. I can't possibly send you into the world with this, you know, with this information. And so a lot of our conversations were a bit about that, really, about kind of understanding that these things that I had sort of taken for granted about how the world worked were really damaging and terrifying and not something I wanted to pass on to him at all.
Yeah. One of the conversations that I describe in my book is my child asking me why people pray. Yeah. And it made me realize that I had to explain organized religion to her from the perspective of a non-believer who doesn't want to necessarily close the door for her on a life choice that she might want to make. And and I feel like, you know, there are so many conversations like that in your book where you kind of depict the kind of the instant panic that one feels as a parent when not only do they have to have a conversation with their child about something really serious, but they need to almost strip their own jaded projections and cynicisms of the world out of it, because that can sometimes feel intellectually dishonest. But also, you don't know everything. So you kind of have to like make some stuff up. It's really fascinating. I love it. That for me, that's when Good Talk is absolutely at its best and absolutely indispensable as a guide to parents on how it's okay to just sit in these conversations and have them as naturally, because that kind of makes you more human to your child. You know, you're not the font of all knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, I think I might regret this when he's a teenager, when I'll wish that he did think I was the fount of all knowledge. I might regret not having some sort of godlike control over him, but yeah, I think at this point he realizes how thoroughly fallible I am. And it's funny what you just said about how we come to these conversations and we almost have to strip ourselves out of them, because that is absolutely true, right? It's like you're trying to tell them about the world and you're like, well, let me also take away me from this, because I'm not entirely sure about myself, and I would like you to be a much better version of me, so let me not try to get too much me on you as I tell you what my mind has made sense of. And it's just this it ends up being this wild conundrum, because you want to make a better human in many ways than the one you have been, and yet the only way to explain to them, you know, parts of the world that you understand is to tell them what you've been through. So it's a lot.
Yeah. And for me, you know, one of those conversations was about having to explain to my child what racism was, because at school she was learning about a civil rights act that happened in Bristol, where we live, that was really famous. Yep. And happened not far from where her school is. And I realized that in trying to talk to her about racism, I started trying to, it was an idea that she just did not understand at all. You know, she just found the idea utterly preposterous. And so I started to be like, well, people might be racist because of, and I started trying to rationalize racism for her in order to make her understand why people might feel that way. And I realized in that moment that I was projecting onto her a level of cynicism that she did not deserve. And it was actually intellectually dishonest of me to even rationalize this utterly preposterous idea. And so I had to just sort of stop myself and go, yeah, you're right. It is a stupid idea.
Also, because we're in the midst of, I mean, I don't know how you've been feeling about this, but I feel like I've been in just a pretty wild learning curve for, I want to say, maybe the last 25 years with trying to kind of undo so many of those ideas that were pushed upon me and so many ways in which I formed in reaction to them, right? So the idea that someone would come to it just saying, but that's such a stupid idea. What a relief. What a relief that somebody can just see that. It's taken me, you know, decades to kind of say it with that level of belief. What a stupid idea, because so much of me has been bent and twisted in reaction to dealing with the racism that's come at me.
Yeah, and the thing is, the moment you start yes anding the idea that it's the feeling that it's stupid by talking about how insidious it is, when she is six and she is in a classroom that is incredibly diverse, there are like three white people in her class, and the moment you start talking about the insidiousness of how silly this whole thing is the moment you start projecting onto her the cynicism of your world rather than letting her find it for herself. And while I want her to know that these things exist and they are damaging, I also want her to form healthy relationships with people. You know, it's a very odd, tricky balance. How have you found that with your kid?
Well, you know, the thing, so my kid, so Z is now 12. And really when I wrote the book, part of the joy of writing it is that he would ask me these questions. You know, there was, I think that in that beginning section you mentioned with Michael Jackson, he asks, is Michael Jackson brown or is he white? And I said, well, he's black, but he's sort of, he turned white. And he said, he turned white? Are you gonna turn white? And I said, no. And he said, is daddy gonna turn white? I said, daddy's already white. He said, was he always? And so the level of question he had was like the kind of questions you would get from a very sweet alien who had just landed on Earth and was trying to figure out what everyone was saying about everything else. Just like, what does this mean, right? And that's a really different question than comes from a 12-year-old boy who is almost my height, has, you know, a reasonable mustache growing in, as would most Indian kids. And also just, and I think is starting to get some of the fear of the world projected onto him, is starting to understand a little bit what it is like to move around the streets when people don't entirely trust you. So I think there's a way in which he's been feeling it firsthand that's quite different than the things I could decide to tell him, right? He's just in the world now. He goes out with a skateboard. He, you know, roams around Brooklyn in between his Zoom classes, and he has, you know, interactions with people. He goes into stores sometimes. He sees how people do and don't look at him. And so I think part of what he's going through now is the things that I can't really protect him from, and I can't explain away.
And obviously this summer, where the huge swathe of Black Lives Matter protests that were happening across the world, but, you know, obviously much more concentrated in America. Was he kind of aware of what was going on?
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, we went to a lot of marches. So they're all, it was one of the great things about living in Brooklyn is that so many of them came right by our apartment and just picked us up. But it really did kind of feel that way. There were so many protests, and also I go to protests all the time, and he came with me several times when I felt it was safe. And I think those moments were really empowering for him. I think the news in America, the media, was really invested in this idea that, you know, all the protests were violent and, you know, people were out of control, but that wasn't my experience of them at all. It was a lot of Black and brown people coming together, and the sense was of shoring each other up and of trying to learn very quickly how to take care of each other in these systems that are constantly evolving methods to keep us apart. So the feeling was quite different, and also a lot of it was just, I think, you know, I mean, I've talked about this before with you a little bit, but I think the idea of wokeness I find so repugnant, because I feel like there's a real bent to it that feels distinctly American, which is the sort of triumphant trajectory that you take at the end of, you know, you're woke and then you understand things and you never again make mistakes. And that just has not been my experience of living in this body, in this life. I feel like I'm constantly learning. So a lot of our work, to be honest, with a 12-year-old boy is is that, is setting up for him the idea that we're never going to have this one cracked. We're never going to have it figured out. We keep going forward anyway, and we keep asking ourselves hard questions about how we're moving through the world as brown people, right? And especially as Indians, who's, you know, who oftentimes, I know many of my relatives were anti-Black and had a lot of issues and would never be able to say that about themselves so clearly, but it was obvious to me, just as I was growing, you know, I grew up with a lot of those ideas in the ether around me. So unpacking that and saying, this is a stance we took, and these are the historical reasons that happened, but it will never, again, to your daughter's point, it will never make sense. There's nothing about this that is normal. There's no reason that we have to take this forward into the world.
You said something really interesting. Oh, you said a lot of interesting things, but not to diminish that. But you said something really interesting there about this idea of, you know, a constant learning and unlearning. And one of the things that I've really noticed in the last 5 years that I have been, I guess, a prominent in the UK member of the culture war for, you know, a title that I would very happily not have, is that a lot of times people are just covering over the fact that they feel uncomfortable. And that that discomfort comes because it's been pointed out that something that they've said is fucked up. And rather than take that and sit with it and learn and do better, they double down. And I think that that's such a strange state of affairs, that actually the braver thing to do is sit with your discomfort, because otherwise you're and then you notice that more and more people decide that they want to sit down and not get involved in these kinds of discussions or these kinds of fights or these kinds of protests, because they're too scared of saying the wrong thing. And you notice that discomfort has become weaponized in a really strange way, where someone's discomfort is now more important than my dignity. And I really hate that, because as a middle-class male from, you know, a Brahmin caste, who is trying my best to kind of unlearn stuff from my own past and all the rest of it, I understand that I have to feel uncomfortable about certain things, and I have to try and do better. And I just wish more people kind of were willing to do that.
But what do you think stops them?
Fear of getting stuff wrong, I think. I think it's as base as that. I don't know.
I think it's shame. Like, I think that there's a way in which all of the learning reroutes to shame, which is an incredibly hard emotion for anybody to hold. You know, like, I think of hard, you know, the hard emotions to hold for me are hope, because it's such a heavy emotion and it takes almost all of my energy to hold hope. But shame wants to eject itself from my body. Shame is that feeling of wanting to outrun your own skin and erase your past and become someone entirely different, the person that didn't make this mistake. And I wonder if part of our work in figuring out how to heal is to help build narratives past shame, which is not to say don't deal with these horrible things that you've done. Of course. But like, for myself, when I'm talking with, for example, an Indian relative who's been extremely anti-Black in the past, and they've sort of rewritten the story to kind of say, like, no, that never happened, and I'm this now, and I'm sort of gently trying to say, but you weren't, and I wasn't either, and part of that is because we didn't know better, and part of it is because we did know better, and we understood that if we aligned ourselves in this way, we would feel less power. What is that? Like, can we just look at that instead of running from that feeling? Can we look at that? Because that's the thing. That to me is the kind of most necessary interruption, right? You only know when you're making a power grab if you look back on the ones that you've made already, and you deal with the idea that you did it. that in fact you did make that move. I find that, I guess what I'm saying is, I find that people are, they want to rush the narrative forward past the shame. But if you rush past that part, you never know how to spot it when it's coming at you again, right? Mm. You never know how to kind of take a moment when you're about to do something horrific to someone and say, oh, this feels like the old thing. This feels like the time I didn't see somebody's humanity. This feels like the time I valued my power over their humanity. This feels like the time I valued, to say what you were just saying, my discomfort over their humanity, right?
Yeah, I really love that, because for me, that's, you present that, for me, that feels like hope. Do you know what I mean? Like this idea that we can sit in these feelings and try and understand where they come from. Because I often worry with my kids that I, you know, kind of going back to kind of like the thematic thing that I keep coming to, I keep worrying about projecting my own shame or my own guilt or my own shit, like my own baggage, onto them. And that is a thing that really worries me. And every now and then I will catch myself doing or being a version of my father that I didn't always appreciate. In a way that's quite innate, because it's a learned behavior. It's a learned thing that I've observed since I was a child. But then, like, you know, how that then manifests in practice is that, like, in order to not be like that version of my father, I will then go so much the other way, so as to be the sort of the direct opposite of him. But, you know, that again, that's not a sustainable way to live your life.
Right. Right. Also, because if you form yourself only in opposition to something, you never figure out what your self is, right? Your actual self is.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Did you always think you were going to have kids? I'm sorry if this is a personal question, but I'm always interested.
No, I didn't. I didn't, mainly because I didn't think I'd be any good at it. Which was also, though, a bummer to me, because I've always loved kids. I've always really enjoyed kids a lot. And I still really enjoy kids a lot, surprisingly, honestly, after being a parent. I didn't always think that I was going to have kids. And as long as we're talking about personal things, my pregnancy wasn't a particularly good one. Like it was like my whole body just revolted, and everything that could go wrong sort of did, one after the other. So I remember thinking at some point, like, this was a bad idea. This was definitely not my best idea. Like, I'm already bad at this, and I'm only, you know, whatever, 14 weeks in or whatever it was. But I was surprised when I had Z. I was surprised by this really incredible thing, which is that he was just his own person. I remember being so relieved about that. Like, the pregnancy had been so brutal and I was so sick. And then when he came out, he was so kind of ferociously strong in a way that I wasn't going to be for months, but like, he was just this other thing that had survived and come out with this, you know, the my family's unibrow and sort of this kind of great, you know, roar of this great roaring cry. And I just remember thinking, like, oh, he's of you, but he's not yours. He is his own thing, and he will find his own way. And it was a really immediate sensation and such relief in that, honestly.
Oh, that's beautiful. I probably didn't incubate. I was searching for the wrong word, the right word, and almost purposefully chose the wrong one. But I kind of, when I held my daughters for the first time, both times, I kind of wanted to draw them into myself as much as possible, because I kind of felt this overwhelming. It's like smothering, but not, again, I'm purposefully using the wrong word to kind of illustrate an extreme version of what I mean, but I just wanted to surround them with myself and kind of protect them from the world. They suddenly seemed so much more in danger because now they were out in the world. It was just such a strange feeling. I didn't understand it at all because I felt like I was again projecting myself onto them or my own fears onto them.
I mean, to be fair, when you're looking at a small newborn baby, it is really like looking at the most vulnerable thing. I mean, don't you remember that moment where they said, now you take the baby home and you're like, that's a bad idea, guys. You know what? I don't think that's a good idea. Like, somebody else should definitely take the baby until the baby is four, certainly until the baby's skull has knit together into some sort of hard shell that cannot be hurt by me, because I'm a very clumsy person. You know, I just remember having that feeling of like, no, this is a very terrifying thing to have somebody this vulnerable. And yet, like, don't you remember those early, like, I always think of this too, even now when I see my son or somebody else's child do something spectacular. I always think of that idea that, you know, that like there's just this sort of innate ability or value that every human life has. And it's wild to see it come out. Sort of an amazing thing to see it come out.
Yeah. I feel like I spent the first 2 weeks suddenly feeling like I was 14 again. And at some point my dad was just going to arrive and say, I'm going to take the baby now. You go and play PlayStation. And no, he never came.
Exactly.
It was terrifying. I've got another thing that I really want to move on to talk to you about, but one of the things that I guess obviously, like, you know, we've spoken a bunch of times, but obviously I don't know you very well at all other than what I've kind of absorbed from your work. But one of the things that really strikes me about you, especially in the way that you present these conversations with your son and the people around you, and this may just be authorial license, but you seem like an incredibly empathetic person, and you just have this sort of gift for capturing conversations, because one of the things that you seem to be really good at is just listening and presenting without judgment. And that to me often feels like a great source of empathy.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. I wonder, I kind of want to run next door and ask Z, like, what do you think? Am I empathetic? I will say that I love conversations. I love the entire idea of people talking to each other. I love it because I do this occasional class on dialogue, and I think a lot about the movie. Did you ever see the movie Arrival?
No.
So that's the one, the Ted Chiang one, that it basically, I don't think this is a spoiler, but also all human people should go see this movie because I think it's absolutely wonderful. But essentially aliens come down. It's like no other alien movie, because essentially what you find out is that they speak a language that's circular. So there's no beginning and end. So everything that is happening has always been happening and will continue to happen. And some way in which our human brains learn that language leads us to understand how things are all interconnected, i.e. to world peace. It's an amazing story. But the great thing about this language, when you see them doing it, and they're this incredible sort of octopus elephant type thing that you can't fathom that somebody came up with this as an idea, but they shoot this circle from their strange paws. And you see the circle of their language, you see the weird way in which it's formed. And I remember thinking at the time, like, holy shit, like, what a way to communicate. What a way to communicate. And like, meanwhile, here on Earth, we are stuck blowing noises through our mouth holes. Like, what a disaster we are. What a cruel thing this is. Because the other part that's so funny to me is that as you're blowing a noise through your mouth hole, somebody else is, the whole time that they are listening to you, is also thinking about the noise that they're going to blow back, which means that they're not even really hearing you. I mean, it's an amazing, it's such a faulty process. Just having any conversations, but I really love how hard we go out with it. Like, this continual belief that we can communicate when, like, everything in the world has showed us we're not that great at it. And I love that humans do this. I think we're such beautiful and strange animals that we will try this over and over again. So I think that's the thing that I love most about conversations is just the idea of how hard we are trying to be understood, and how miserably we fail even though we keep trying. Like, I love all of that about us.
Yeah, and I often think that the good difference, the smart difference between a writer who is a good listener and a writer who is a bad listener, and you can tell which of those is a good writer, but is a difference between someone who is actively listening to you and reflecting on the things that you're actually saying in the moment, and the person who is just waiting for that me now, me next. This reminds me of a story that happened to me once, kind of conversations. And I get the impression from the series of conversations that you've collected that you're definitely an active listener, which I think stands people in good stead for being empathetic parents as well.
Oh boy. Well, I'm delighted that you say that. And I might actually just record this, keep this, you know, and for those future teenage moments that I think are like coming right down the pike, I'm going to hold this up as evidence to the child.
Hold on, the check that you sent me to, in order to say that just bounced. I'm really sorry. I'm going to have to retract that entire thing. but onto another thing, which, I hope you don't mind talking about, but I guess the other thing that kind of makes me feel a kinship with you is we both lost parents not long before we had kids.
Yes.
And the way you write about grief and inheritance in your book is some of the most beautiful stuff I've ever read. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that process of grieving for a parent and raising a child and how those two things kind of went for you. I mean, if you want to know how it went for me, read
my book. Absolutely do. That's what I was going to say. I mean, I'm happy to talk about this, but I'm also, because I thought you handled it so beautifully in your book, and I'm very curious about what you told yourself to kind of get those passages down as clearly as you did. For me, what would I say about that? You know, that passage, there's a passage with my father in the book, in the moments that we realize that he really is going to die. And it's sort of a longer story about always wanting to smoke pot with my parents, you know, because here, honestly, like, there's this sort of idea of the Californian parent that smokes weed with their kids and is so cool. And if you do that with your parents, it's so cool. And it was like some other thing that I knew I was never going to be a part of, because my parents were such square immigrants, and, you know, and I was their sort of uptight and nerdy and constantly worried child who did bad things, but only when I was absolutely sure no aunties could see me, you know, that kid. So then this idea when my dad was dying, the idea that he was, you know, we started giving him weed so that he could eat, and he sort of became this other floaty parent, and this sort of other version of himself. And I got to stay with that person for months before he died. And that chapter is a bit about that, about the sort of stoner conversations that we were having, but also what it was like to finally get the thing that you most longed for in the way that you would never want it. And I think for me, you know, it's funny that you asked this, because it's 4 days until the anniversary of my dad's death, and I know this from following you on social media, that day also lives with you. The day of loss lives with you. And it's just, there's a way in which I find my body contorting in this moment to sort of to brace itself. Even though it's been, you know, it's been years and years at this point, I think I'm always surprised when they say grief is cyclical. You know, and they kind of, you know, all those smarter people than me will say grief is a cycle. And I never understood what that meant. But to me, the closest sense I can make of it is how I always think of grief as like a planet that you never know how close you are orbiting to it. And so occasionally you'll just get sucked into its gravity, but like from out of nowhere. You know, you'll be walking along and you know, picking up the newspaper and getting some, you know, a can of beer from the store. And then suddenly you'll remember that you had a dad once and he was amazing. He was amazing. And he talked to you like no one else ever talked to you. And he was more interested in your life than anyone ever was or ever will be again. And that was a real thing that you had. And you forget in that moment all the flaws that your father had too, because you just remember the feeling of being seen in a way that you'll never be seen again. Right.
Yeah. Yes.
That thing. Yeah. And what about you? You were writing your passages, which were beautiful.
Oh, no, thank you. It's interesting that thing about commemorating dates I find difficult, because everything within me is like, it's just a day. It's just a day. You have to just treat it like a day. But the problem with trying to trick your brain like that is you're just drawing more attention to it. And, my mum's death and her mother's death, they both, my ba died on the same day Amy Winehouse died. So yeah. I will never forget the day my ba died, because people talk about Amy Winehouse a lot. And my mum's birthday is September the 11th. And I really remember phoning my mum on her birthday as soon as I got up. And I happened to be in America at the time. And so it was morning for me and afternoon for her. And I was waking up to call her to wish her happy birthday. And she was like, what the fuck is happening in New York? And so those dates would just always be like monoliths that I'm heading towards at any given time. And, you know, much as you try your best to swerve them or like throw a blanket over them and pretend they're not there, they are always there. And that idea of cyclicalness, I also find that interesting, because I also think that there is something about grief that flattens time in a way, because my mum has been dead for 10 years this year, but she's also been dead for 2 days, and she's been dead for 4 months, and she's been dead my entire life, my entire adult life, it feels like. And in that way that time flattens the grief, I feel all of those emotions along the timeline of her not being with me all at once at the same time. It's very strange.
Yeah. I mean, I really hear that. And I think that is also, I feel like that's evident in your book, both in how you write about her, but also about the connection that you miss between her and your children, right? Because I think that's something else that's hard to reconcile with, you know, the kind of being a father that your mother never gets to really know in that way, you know, the kind of father that you become, and not having the parent to kind of bounce that off of.
Yeah, because I think I wonder how much I would have sought her out for advice. And I feel like, you know, she was a teenager in this country. She would have understood what it's like to grow up. What it's like to grow up as a young brown child in these times, and she would have been able to give me perspective and all the rest of it. I learned an interesting thing about my mum right at the start of lockdown. I was exchanging voice notes with her best friend. I decided to get in touch with her best friend and get her to share with me memories of my mum. And she told me something about her that I'd never known before. I'd specifically asked her to tell me about my mother before she was my mother. I wanted to know what she was like as a teenager, but when she had teenage hopes and dreams and posters of boys and whoever on her wall and all the rest of it, who, like, what was the name she was writing over and over again in the back of her exercise book? That's the stuff I wanted to know.
Yeah.
And my mum's friend told me that when she and my mum were teenagers, they both protested the local newspaper where they grew up, because every time they reported on a crime that had been committed by a person of color, they specified the ethnicity, and they both found that incredibly racist. And this was the 60s, and they led a big protest against this local newspaper, who eventually changed the way they reported crime by people of color, which I thought was amazing to know that my mum, even then, was like doing these small pieces of activism that I guess I do in my life now. And I've always wondered where that's come from, but I think it's always just been in me, that in the way that some certain things are innate.
Oh, that's amazing. That's really amazing. What a gift. Yeah, what a gift to find that out. I think that's, you know, what's so interesting about that too, is because I think there's, that to me is one of those incredible gifts, because in some ways you have the relationship with the parent that you lose that you have, right? You can't go back to it and you can't change it. But something like this, like finding out that there's still so much of her in you that you wouldn't have even necessarily been able to place before, but now you can. Like, what a strange, how did that feel for you?
It felt, I think it felt important because, you know, in death, as you were saying, we kind of tend to memorialize people. We tend to think about their best qualities and the qualities that weren't so great that now make us roll our eyes decades later. But those details, those small details, those small insignificant details, those small everyday acts, that they're the things that make a person, I think. There's this wonderful quote from, I'm just going to pause while I find it so I don't butcher it, because I think it's a lovely thing that I'm going to share with you. It's somewhere in this notebook. I should just fold down the page because I seem to refer to it a lot. Sorry, one second. I will edit all this out. Or maybe I won't. Maybe I'll just give people a little peek behind the curtain.
Just the feel of the pages turning.
Just feel the pages turning, guys. Oh, I can't find it. There's this really great quote from Zadie Smith in an essay in Feel Free, where she's talking about the I who is not me. And I'm paraphrasing this now because I couldn't find the thing in my notebook quick enough. But she talks about how the way people are in public, you know, their mannerisms, the way they dress, the way they talk, those are the things that give us a sense of a person. Those are the things that kind of lead us into their interiority. And I think that's really important. I think what Zadie Smith is trying to say is like the specificity of people is what gives us their universality. And so in order to understand what the core self of my mum was, I have to know about the specifics. And that's why, like, talking to a friend in this way has been a really, really fascinating thing for me.
It's so interesting too, because I'm thinking also about how that relates to writing, because you and I have both been at this for a bit. And I don't know if this happened to you when you were first writing, but I remember when I was writing when I was younger, and I'm talking, you know, 15, 20 years ago, when I would try to write about my experience. And I'm a Syrian Christian Indian who grew up in New Mexico with not a lot of other Syrian Christian Indians around me. In fact, there was one family. But I remember trying to write about it, and the editors that I was talking to always kind of wanted me to sort of, well, this seems really specific. What's a more like common Indian thing? Like what's a more sort of, it was like this idea that they had about what an every Indian would feel, as though that is even a thing. You know, it was like, they didn't want the specificity because they almost felt like, but it's specific enough that you're Indian, isn't it? Do you really need to go into all of these different levels? And one of my great joys really in writing Good Talk was just getting to be as specific as I am and getting to write down that exact experience. And the really wild thing about it is how many people have related to it not being Syrian Christian Indians who grew up in New Mexico, right? Like not needing to have my same specificity to understand what it is like to come from a very specific background and to always feel both responsible for and burdened by and so terribly proud of that background.
Yeah, but I think that's because readers and viewers of television and all the rest of it have been taught to not see the universal in the specificity of others. Like what is specific for us can often be shorthand for other people. And you know, I think often, like, you know, we live in a world where there were people in 2015 who were willing to suspend their disbelief for a film where there were ghosts that needed busting, but they couldn't suspend their disbelief enough for the thought that four women could do it. And that to me just shows me how small people's imaginations are. Right. That, you know, it is only through the specificity of how we record lives that we are able to lead the reader into something that's much deeper, that like a deeper connection. Like how much growing up did I, you know, see myself in people like Peter Parker and you know, Adrian Mole and all of these people who didn't, like, you know, I don't necessarily think that people need to look like me all the time in order for me to see myself within them, but I do think if you are the type of reader who wants to feel like books are for you, then that kind of representation can be important at critical times in your life. Mm-hmm. But it's so bizarre to me that people put a barrier up to it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I found it, I've sort of been delighted with this, I know I was talking about the shame being a kind of terrible thing earlier in our conversation, but I honestly appreciate the great shaming of the literary establishment in the last years, and specifically the short-sightedness of many editors' bookshelves, the inability, you know, the taking apart of the idea of, well, I just look for stories that appeal to me, never looking at how small their lens was. Mm. And I appreciate that people are at least beginning to struggle to question that part of themselves, to say what stories appeal to me and why, and what am I overlooking in my great need to find something that appeals to me? What am I overlooking? You know, what are the stories that don't appeal to me, but I desperately need to hear anyway?
Mm.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Okay, so before we finish up, before I've got a couple of questions for you just to finish on, but before we do, are you able to tell us what you're working on at the moment, or is it at a stage where actually it's...
I can tell you a bit. I can tell you a bit. So one thing... I'll just say I'm in an especially good mood today because I just finished a short story, and it had been a little while since I had written a piece of fiction that I felt finished. The rest is a novel that I'm working on, and as you know, novels are these kind of very unwieldy beasts, and I'm very happy to be working on that novel, but it felt really good to dial into a small story and finish it and to live in that world completely. And then the other thing I'm working on, which is far more glamorous, is a sort of fictionalized television version of Good Talk, which I can't say much more about it other than the process is really incredibly exhilarating.
Oh, I'm so excited for that. I am so excited for that. Thank you. Sorry, I was just excited at the prospect of fiction, and then I was trying to remember where it may even have been the Meris Review podcast where you were talking about how actually it was such a massive pain in the ass to do a graphic novel, and I wondered if you saw yourself doing more graphic conversations a la this. I mean, if people follow the Good Talk Thanks Instagram account, you do every now and then post up new conversations and snippets and fragments, but do you see yourself illustrating more stuff in the future?
I think absolutely, because there are times even now when because that format is just so, I mean, now that I've done it, it's really kind of delicious and easy for me. So there are times even now where I think, oh, that would make a really good, it kind of gives me a way to do a short drawn story that's very dialogue based. And it uses these muscles that I really enjoy, which is you can't dive into your metaphors. You can't go into the kind of the very deep, deep specificities of what you're feeling. You only have the dialogue and the characters to move the page. What happens? And so there's a lot of freedom in that kind of constriction, right? Like as a creator, and I'm sure, I feel like, what am I telling you this for? But I think as people who create things, we know that the real pleasure lies within learning how to maneuver around the constrictions. So yeah, I'll definitely return to that format.
Oh, amazing. And what has been the best piece of advice you've ever received and the most useless piece of advice you've ever received as a parent?
As a parent, like the best piece of advice about parenting?
Yeah.
I think the best piece of advice about parenting was something that I read about letting your child guide the conversation, especially when it's in these really rough areas of race and sexuality and all the rest of it, in these very loaded areas. Sometimes they'll ask you a question. They'll ask you a kind of relatively minor question, and you think you have to forward it into this incredibly large conversation. So they'll ask you something that will tip off the, this is racism, you know, flag in your head. And then you're suddenly explaining the entire dynamics of how the USA was started, you know, just that kind of thing. When really what you need to do is just answer the question you've been asked and let them ask you more questions. That's been really helpful for me, especially in not setting up disastrous conversations, despite what I just said on this podcast. Okay. I just want to say, I mostly get that one right. And then the most useless piece of advice is actually more of a scolding that I usually get from older white women, which is more, oh, he doesn't need to know about any of that. That's not something a child of his age needs to know, which is just preposterous to me on so many levels, as if they understand the first thing about being in a body like his, as if they don't understand that the thing that I'm protecting him from half the time is the things they think of him. The idea that I'm supposed to hide him behind an innocence that they're hiding behind themselves, I just find it really cruel and really awful, and a way that they will send my child into the world without any armor on when I am doing my best to keep a reliable amount of honor of armor on while also just honoring the heart under it, you know?
I love that so much. Thank you. Thank you, Mira Jacob.
Thanks for having me. That's what, the weather went by fast. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for listening today. Your support means absolutely everything to me, and I really hope you're getting something from these podcasts. I book, research, record, edit, upload, and promote the podcast all by myself, with a little bit of support from my publishers at Bluebird, but mostly it's me. So I'm glad it's resonating with readers. Please do continue to support me and the podcast by buying the book, of the guests, supporting us on social media with tweets and Instagram posts and all the rest of it. A bunch of you are already doing that, and that is brilliant. It fills my heart with joy every time I see it. Telling people about the podcast, liking it, subscribing to it, all that kind of stuff. There is an Acast supporter feature as well, if you want to chuck me a couple of extra quid to help caffeinate me while I spend entire evenings editing this. I'm not a sound engineer. I'm trying my best, okay? Hopefully the volume issue is sorted now. But anyway, thank you for sticking with me this far. I hope you enjoyed today. We've got two more episodes left in this season. Next week, we have Hari Kundru, and then I'm going to close the season with one of my closest friends, the comedian Josie Long. Okay, everyone, thank you very much. Goodbye.
Brown baby, I am brown baby. Yes, I am.
Silly brown baby. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.